around 5, and I thank you very much for your loyalty in coming. So good to see you all again. The 20th century, of course, what happened in medicine, I suppose you can just take 5 years of the 20th century, and that would be more than probably happened from 3000 BC up until 1900. So my challenge is to try to highlight for you what I think are the seminal advances in clinical medicine in the first half of the 20th century. And then as we come to the second half of the 20th century, to discuss with you the phenomena you're aware of, stem cells and transplantation and all the things that we all have some knowledge about, to try to put that in perspective, at least my own personal perspective, as to what of those, which of those contributions is clearly a benefit, which still hold promise, and which I think are going to fade away. So in other words, let's go back to our analogy of orbiting the Earth in the space shuttle. Remember, to encompass 3000 BC to 500 AD, we had to orbit and look from afar to get a big overall view. So we need to take ourselves up an even higher orbit now to try to see what happened in the 20th century in perspective. Easy to spend an hour talking about lots of little details and it'll go in one ear out the other and none of us would benefit. So this is the big picture as I see it. Well, the 20th century started enthusiastically with the Wright brothers, 1903, North Carolina, the first recorded powered controlled flight. And this ushered in a new century, a new era. Also, in the first decade of the 20th century, the biggest passenger ship ever built, the most luxurious passenger ship ever built, was launched, and in 1912 went on its voyage, sadly never to arrive. 2 years after that calamity, Europe and much of the world was engulfed in the carnage of the First World War. Some 10 million people died, and historians to this day are in general agreement that for all that sacrifice, very little was achieved. That was followed in turn by the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl in America, the Wall Street crash. What a miserable beginning to a century. But there were advances in science, and it's to this gentleman that we owe probably the most important seminal contribution to physics since Newton with his theories of relativity. So things looked good, but were of course subverted. Medicine had a much better outlook. And I think we've talked negatively about psychiatry mainly because well-intentioned people were trying to do the right thing for patients with mental disorders, but to very little avail, as we discovered hitherto. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that the first real therapeutic advance, albeit very limited, was psychoanalysis. And this is the actual couch used in Vienna by Sigmund Freud. You recall that he was obliged to leave his native Vienna when the Nazis occupied that country. And he became in exile. He was in exile in London. And those of you who may be familiar with London may have visited the museum to Freud, which is in fact his house while he was in exile in North London, just a few hundred yards off the Finchley Road. And this is his original couch. And this psychoanalysis was completely revolutionary. And what he was proposing was to allow what was in the subconscious to come to the surface and thereby help people who had what we would now call neuroses rather than psychoses, anxiety states, obsessive behavior, and various other aspects. His idea, this was called the talking cure. And you talked, of course, reclined in a couch. And this caught on throughout Europe, and particularly in North America. And here is Freud himself. You can see at the bottom left of that picture, leaning on his cane with a cigar, in 1909, on a lecture tour of the United States. And his colleague in this endeavor, Jung, is seated to the right of the bearded gentleman in the middle. He was his American host. Freud and Jung parted company due to the importance in sexuality in raising these latent... oh my goodness me, I'm going to need some help. Where have I been? So sorry. Freud, however, had no illusion as to what contribution he was making to psychiatry, and he freely acknowledged he could do nothing for what we would now call bipolar disorder, or schizophrenia, or the psychoses and other major psychiatric problems. But nonetheless, this was the first real progress for these relatively minor psychiatric disorders, which were nevertheless disabling for those afflicted. Well, there were advances that took place in psychiatry beyond that, and as we get towards the second half of the 20th century, we can highlight, I think, two contributions which have placed psychiatry fully in the realm of science, which it wasn't before, in truth, for treatments that were confined to insulin comas, electroconvulsive therapy, which although having some striking success in a few patients, seemed rather a barbaric way of shaking up the brain by applying electrodes and electric current and rather a terrifying physiological assault, but some benefit, and even surgical procedures on the brain were carried out in an attempt to correct some disorders, frontal lobotomy, for example, to calm people down who were harming themselves. The first major advance, I think, beyond psychoanalysis in psychiatry that occurred was an awareness that these disorders had to be classified. And there was no classification hitherto. And it was only in the middle of the 20th century that classification of psychiatric disorders came into their own. You remember that picture of Hogarth, with people of all sorts of, with all sorts of mental disturbance thrown together as a sort of traveling, as a sort of circus for visitors. And now there was a real attempt to segregate symptom complexes and give them names. And then drugs came along as pharmacology began to develop, particularly chlorpromazine and lithium and the antidepressants. And these have been genuine advances in psychiatry. So I'm not talking psychiatry, but I'm looking for solid scientific evidence of the benefit of any therapeutic endeavor. What are the hospitals? You remember the big building spree for big hospitals in the last half of the 19th century with the object of studying patients and putting them all together. And before the real 1950s and 1960s, when classification and drugs began to come into their own, in the early years of the 20th century, it was appreciated that these large hospitals were, in terms of benefit to the patients, achieving nothing. They were expensive to maintain, and therefore, systematically, in Britain and in much of Europe, and indeed in the United States and Canada, these were progressively closed down. The question then is, where do the patients go? And they were returned to the community, which is a euphemistic way of saying they were abandoned. And here we see a photograph taken of three such patients who had previously been comfortably housed in one of these mental institutions, harming neither themselves nor anybody else, but were now street people, and this photograph was taken in a church shelter where they had some soup and some warmth for the night of the winter's evening. So that's a sorry situation. So that was really all I want to say about psychiatry at the moment, because I think, in fairness, I'm not sure we've advanced very much beyond lithium and the antidepressants, and some medicines which are helpful in some forms of schizophrenia, true. But in terms of the advances that have been made in general medicine, in obstetrics, in surgery, in immunology, in every other field, I think we still have to say that psychiatry is still the Cinderella of medicine, with work still to be done. So let's move on to what I think was the next significant advance that had enormous impact way beyond psychoanalysis. And that is the development of x-rays. Remember, up until 1900, there weren't any x-rays. But let me tell you the story of the x-ray, because we owe this to the professor of physics in Würzburg in Germany, Wilhelm Conrad Rundstedt, who was awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics for his discovery of X-rays. And here he is himself, and this is his laboratory. And what he did was, at the time, among physicists, electricity was the new wonder of the age. It was well known that if you passed an electric current through an electrode and placed another piece of metal against that electrode, the current would be transmitted and carry on to a wire and do whatever you wanted to do with the electricity. If you separated the electrodes, the current seemed to stop. And what was discovered was that if you pass the electric current through one electrode separated from another by a distance, but did this within a glass flask from which all the air had been withdrawn, in other words, a vacuum tube, the current would be transmitted. And so Röntgen was experimenting with this to try to understand the physics of this phenomenon of electricity passing through a vacuum. And what he did was, in order not to confound his observations with daylight, he covered his vacuum tube through which he was going to pass current with a cardboard. Unknown to him, his assistant had been using that cardboard to measure out powdered barium sulfate. So there were the residues of barium sulfate on the cardboard. And Röntgen threw the switch, electric current went through the tube, and to his surprise, he found the barium sulfate glowed. And clearly, there was some emanation or radiation coming from the tube, which was causing a change in this powder. He didn't know, he assumed it was a radiation by definition, didn't know what to call it, and in mathematics, X is for the unknown, and so these were X-rays. He took a picture of his wife's hand 2 weeks after making this observation by making a little aperture in the cardboard through which he passed the current. And there is his wife's hand, the first known X-ray. The wife is wearing a ring, as you can see, on her fourth finger. Now in Paris, Henri Becquerel was a physicist who had read of Röntgen's observations about X-rays. Becquerel's interest was not in X-rays, which were a new phenomenon, but in the phenomenon of fluorescence. That is something that glows spontaneously in the dark. And he was working with uranium powder, which has this property. And he copied what Röntgen had done to see if some form of radiation was responsible for this glowing of radium powder, of the uranium powder. And instead of using cardboard, Lumière, who we now know as the father of cinematography, had developed a photographic film. And he thought, well, perhaps he could capture this radiation, if that's what it was causing fluorescence, by covering a packet of uranium powder, uranium salts, with Lumière's photographic film. And he thought, well, if there is radiation, the film would become exposed. And just to be sure, as a sort of control, he inserted between the packet of the uranium powder and Lumière's photographic film a metal cross. And he just waited to see what happened. And here we have a photograph of the actual film, Lumière's film, dark area, the big rectangle spot at the top, you can see, is film that had been exposed to some form of radiation, and light, of course, is a form of radiation. And there is the cross which prevented the radiation getting onto the film. Isn't that remarkable? So now we have not only X-rays, but also we have radiation as a phenomenon in nature. Becquerel's fame spread far and wide, and a 24-year-old Polish student of physics, Maria Skłodowska, asked if she could join his laboratory. She came from Warsaw, did so in Paris, and there she was assigned a project under the guidance of Becquerel's assistant, Pierre Curie. And the rest, of course, is history. They married, and she devoted her life to the therapeutic use of the radiation which Becquerel had discovered. And in 1903, she, her husband, and Becquerel were awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics for their contributions. So now we have X-rays, and now we have radiotherapy. There she is with her husband. The next advance, really, is in terms of physiology. You remember we discussed yesterday how Harvey had discovered the circulation of the blood by a very simple observation of placing a light tourniquet and releasing it and watching the blood circulate. Why nobody had come across that before, one wonders, but there we are. And also that Claude Bernard had recognized respiration was the transfer of oxygen from the blood, from the lungs to the blood, and giving up of carbon dioxide. But that was as far as physiology went at the beginning of the 20th century. But now, an observation was made. You remember also that Claude Bernard had recognized the pancreas produces chemicals which we call digestive juices, which help digest food in the gut. So the pancreas was an area of interest. But it was observed early in the first decade of the 20th century, that there was a family of chemicals produced by the body which curiously didn't seem to act where they were in contact, where they were released, like the pancreatic juice coming out into the duodenum and physically acting on the food that had been digested. But these chemicals seemed to be produced by the intestinal tract, but disappeared into the blood and acted at a distance. And the first of these was a chemical which was given the name secretin, which was produced, as you can see from this slide here. This is a section of the stomach, the human stomach, and you can see the rather globular-looking cells at the bottom here for which the secretin would have been produced. It goes into the bloodstream and then it acts on the digestive juices at a distance. So in other words, nature has designed that as you put something in your stomach, the pancreas is primed to start producing digestive juices. Isn't that beautiful? The elegance of the human body. Because this was the first, therefore, of what are called hormones. And hormones are the means whereby endocrinologists earn their bread and butter. So secretin was the first hormone to be discovered, and then shortly after, thyroxine. And it was known that if you took up the macerated thyroid gland of an animal and gave it to somebody who was very lethargic and had been putting on weight and was clearly, by today's diagnostic criteria, suffering from hypothyroidism, that patient would be effectively treated. So now you have not only physiology, but therapy as a result from these observations. The great killer among endocrine disorders, of course, was diabetes. And prior to the discovery of insulin, there was no treatment. Those of you who may be diabetic know how carefully you have to watch your blood sugars, but can you imagine what the situation would have been like where there was no treatment available? It was observed, however, because the histologists were looking at tissues through the microscope, you remember we talked about last time, it was recognized that within the pancreas, and here we're looking at the cells that produce the enzymes that digest food, all these dark things here, this is a very magnified view, the pancreas would go way out of the room here on that scale. There were little islands of cells here which seemed to have a mysterious function. And it's required Frederick Banting and Charles Best, two Canadian physiologists, to discern what those cells did. And they are the cells, of course, that produce insulin. They took out the pancreas of dogs, made the dogs diabetic, and then ground up the islet cells, and in the same way as giving ground up thyroid to patients who were hypothyroid, gave the dogs as part of their feed the ground up pancreatic islet cells, but sadly they all died. So clearly this was either not effective or it could not be, the product of these cells could not be absorbed from the gastrointestinal tract. To cut a long story short, they discovered eventually over 3 years of laborious work that if this product from the islet cells was given intravenously, then all was well and the dog survived. And for this, Frederick insulin, of course, became widely available. And for this, Frederick Banting was awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics in Medicine in 1923, at the age of 32, the youngest recipient ever. And well deserved too, I'm sure you would agree. At the same time, people were aware that the nervous system was a little more complex than the early physiologists had thought. We know there are nerves that convey sensation from the skin to the brain, so we can feel things, and we know there are nerves that go in the opposite direction, so we can move our muscles. But it was now being appreciated for the first time that there was a family of nerves that seemed to supply, that did supply, the heart, blood vessels, the bowel, and bladder, what we now call the autonomic nervous system. The chemists got to work to try to understand how the electric current that passed through a neuron, a nerve cell, to send messages along the nerve, how these actually worked. And they identified at the end of the axon, which is the long part of the nerve cell, chemicals that were actually released, neurotransmitters as we now call them. The pharmacologists got busy and looked at the structure of these neurotransmitters and were fairly easily able to make chemicals that blocked those neurotransmitters. Now, for the first time, if you block the neurotransmitters that are causing blood vessels to go into spasm and cause hypertension, you can now, for the first time, treat hypertension. Isn't that remarkable? What about the family doctor? Remember we saw the man, family doctor, last time, with his beard in his face, sitting in a simple house, holding the hand of a patient who was eternally grateful that he came and listened to what he had to say. And that was true at the beginning of the 20th century. But as the 20th century evolved, changes occurred in what we would now call family practice. The first change was beneficial. The first people to buy the motor car, which was coming into its own in the last years of the 19th century and the first decade of the 20th century, were physicians, so that they would not have to order a horse and cart to take them through the snow to see their patient. Furthermore, the invention of the telephone meant that when a patient was sick, previously a runner would go from the family's house to the doctor's house, rap at the door, say, "Doctor, doctor, come quickly, mother is ill." And the doctor would not know any better, would come in his car and horse and take a long time. The telephone allowed him to start to triage the necessity for a call. But unfortunately, this went a little bit too far. And that as the century progressed, well, let me just interject to say that there were social changes as well as changes in the way that family doctors conducted their business. In the 1920s, 1930s, government began to get involved in healthcare for the first time, other than before the standardization of medical education that we saw coming in the Medical Reform Act in Britain in 1854. Government became involved. And I remember as a schoolboy growing up in London, not many years after the Second World War had ended, receiving government orange juice, which was distributed free of charge, and that school break at 10 to 11 in the morning, we all had to form a line and take our bottle of milk. And these were to prevent scurvy and to prevent rickets. So government was getting involved. And that dialogue between physicians, the public, and government continues to this day. The family doctor would be treating essentially, for the first half of the 20th century, tonsillitis, diphtheria very rarely, bronchitis, the simple things, colds, influenza. But the whole picture changed dramatically in 1918 with the onset of the great influenza epidemic, which, over the course of 2 years, killed, it is estimated, 15 million people, more than casualties in the First World War. There was, of course, nothing you could do. We now know this is a virus, and even now, viruses are difficult to control, as we know only too well. But nothing was available other than symptomatic treatment. And if you were elderly or young, your mortality, if you acquired this virulent form of influenza, suddenly had mutated and was decimating country after country. If you were affected in that vulnerable age group, your mortality was 50%. The second scourge in the first half of the 20th century, apart from influenza, which seemed to fade out and become more benign as strangely and suddenly as it became virulent 2 years previously, was poliomyelitis. And I remember very well every time I ran a fever, and if I had a little bit of a headache, the doctor would come in rather grave, and the first thing he would do, he would twitch my ankle up to stretch my Achilles tendon, which stretches the sciatic nerve, which, if the membranes of the spine are inflamed, would cause pain. It's a test still we use today for meningitis. And that would be the prime concern. I remember our local swimming pool being closed every summer for several months at a time when a case of poliomyelitis had occurred, for which, of course, there was no treatment. Now, poliomyelitis affects the nerves of the motor part of the spinal cord, the nerve cells responsible for movement. And if the segment of the cord where the poliomyelitis virus settles is sufficiently high, it will paralyze the muscles that cause respiration. So the patient may be well, not toxic, but unable to breathe. And because no fundamental treatment was available, symptomatic treatment was all we could offer. And for that, the iron lung was invented. You may remember the iron lung. It sort of came and then it disappeared. But the idea is exactly what happens in a polio epidemic in the 1930s. This picture was taken in 1927. Hundreds, scores of patients with poliomyelitis. And what the iron lung does was it applies pressure to the chest and then a partial vacuum to draw the chest out, simulating normal respiration so the patient could continue. The disease would either recover spontaneously or would end up fatal, but no fundamental therapeutic treatment. And of course, it's difficult to estimate now what a reaction there was when Jonas Salk came up with his polio vaccine. And this was in 1953. And what a revolution that was, and a sigh of relief. I could see the wrinkles of my mother's face of tension fade when she was aware that this vaccine was available. Family practice changed, however. And family practice changed to the point that house calls were now becoming rarer and rarer, prompting this cartoon in the satirical magazine Punch, which is now defunct. The husband is lying in bed, looking very sorry for himself, his eight medicines on the bedside. The wife has just put the phone down, having spoken to the family doctor, and the husband says, "What did he say?" And she says, "The doctor says he doesn't visit anymore. Why don't you drop in when you're feeling better?" And that sad state, I'm afraid, has continued to today. The story of antibiotics. Let me just spend a moment on the story of antibiotics. We're all familiar with Alexander Fleming and the apocryphal story that he left in his quench a dish containing bacteria, and in the morning, fungus or something had alighted, and the bacteria were dead, and he discovered penicillin. Well, that's the short story. The long story is actually much more involved than that, but I'm not going to go into too much detail other than to say that Alexander was not the first pioneer for antibiotic. It was this man, Ehrlich, Paul Ehrlich, who was working in the laboratory of Robert Koch in Berlin. You remember Koch, who had supported Pasteur, confirmed the identification of microorganisms, dispensed once and for all the theory of spontaneous generation of decay, and the bacterial theory was alive and well. And the problem with the bacteria is that they're very difficult to see. And Koch charged Ehrlich with the task of developing a stain to make the bacteria more easy to see and identify. Obviously, you think of it, but not easy to do. And here are some bacteria. The blue ones are called cocci, and the red ones are called bacilli, for what it's worth, it doesn't matter. This is a modern stain, but Ehrlich was working on different sorts of dyes. Now, the chemical industry at the time had produced aniline, which was widely used for dyeing materials and products coming out of factories. And so we thought aniline was a dye, it was a simple molecule, and he was playing with aniline in various forms with bacteria to see if the aniline would stick. And then something just struck it. He said he did actually find dye that stuck to the bacteria, making them easy to see. But then he said, if he modified the dye in some way, as it clearly sticks to the bacterium, could it not be that if the dye was sufficiently toxic, it might actually kill the bacterium? And that was a huge leap, just a little leap, and that's how medical progress is made. I think little leaps building on what had happened before, rather than, as I said yesterday, lightning coming down and striking the genes. That just doesn't happen. So what, let me just go back to Ehrlich, then was working, Ehrlich was then working on the dyes and actually came up with a dye which was called salvarsan by nature of its composition, which on experimental animals did seem to prevent death in some animals who were experimentally given streptococci, which would cause septicemia. So it did seem to have some benefit, but not a great deal. It was difficult. It was difficult to produce, it had to be given intravenously, and it didn't look as though it had a commercial future. Meanwhile, Alexander Fleming did indeed, in St Mary's Hospital in London in 1927, go home one evening, not noticing that a dish of bacteria that he had just plated out was left uncovered overnight. And indeed, the next morning, it is true, there were zones of inhibition, as we would say nowadays, around the bacteria. What we're looking at here is the dish. The hazy sky blue background is a swarming bacterium that has covered the whole plate. The underlying material of the plate is actually dark blue. And you can see in these areas here, the dark blue is showing through, showing the bacteria not only couldn't grow, but have actually been killed where these organisms had alighted. And so there was great interest in this, and he said, well, clearly something has happened which could be therapeutically beneficial. The actual substance that had landed on the plate was analyzed repeatedly and was identified as the mold Penicillium. And this was studied, and then the task arose, how do you extract the active ingredient that was causing the inhibition? It was known to be very powerful, because if you took a fragment of the mold and diluted it 800 times, it still had the same inhibitory effect on bacteria growing on a dish. Enormously powerful. And it took a long time for the penicillin, as it's now called, to be developed. Meanwhile, this man, Gerhard Dolmack, who was chief chemist and director of the Bayer company in Germany, which you remember at the end of the 19th century, pioneered the manufacture of aspirin, phenacetin, and paracetamol, was still working on the salvarsan dye that Ehrlich had discovered at the behest of Koch. He said there was continuity in Berlin to try to develop something out of this dye. And eventually, the molecule was modified. It was a very simple molecule. Do you remember that stamp I showed of Kekulé from the East German Republic? His centenary year, he had discovered this benzene ring, this hexagon. And the aniline part, which is the dye, is this nitrogen-hydrogen component, a bit of sulfur, and a very, very simple molecule, which a chemist looking at that says, oh, that's easy, I can make that. And this was, in fact, the first true antibiotic. Sulfanilamide. And it was sulfanilamide was the first effective antibacterial agent to be discovered. Even though work was going on in penicillin, it was still not purified, it was not identified as certainly away from being therapeutically useful. So here was sulfanilamide now being made. And it was sold, marketed in Britain by the May and Baker Company, and it was marketed as MNB963. And I don't know, I see some knowing looks in the audience. I remember being given MNB when I had tonsillitis. That's where it came from, thanks to Dolmack working in Berlin, discovered the formula that worked. So MNB is sulfanilamide, thanks to Ehrlich and thanks to Koch. Isn't it interesting how it all goes back? logical train of development.
What was the date?
Say again?
What was the date?
The date is 1936. If I'm not accurate in that, I'll come to you after. It's within a year or two, 1936. So I was one of the early recipients of MND, as some of you were the earliest students, but there was a very distinguished early recipient, Winston Churchill. And Churchill, as you know, used to drink 6 glasses of brandy a day and smoke as many cigars, so his immune system and bronchial tubes weren't in the best of shape, in spite of appearances to the contrary. And he had just given his darkest hour speech in the House of Commons in 1941. And it wasn't in the darkest hour of the Blitz, it just happened, and the German invasion of Britain seemed to be imminent. And this was Britain's darkest hour. He went home, and the next morning had florid bronchopneumonia. And in those days, pneumonia was quite likely to be lethal. He was given MND, as I was, and as some of you were, made a recovery, and had it not been for MND, perhaps the history of Western Europe might have been different. The penicillin story continued right up until 1944, and one of the consequences of the Nazi occupation of Europe was a number of Jewish emigres, including this man, who, together with Howard Florey, this is Mark Haim, who was pioneering the analysis of penicillin, as it came to be called, and together with Florey, Australian, Kane and Florey had identified the active substance in the penicillium mold that could be safely given penicillin. And the first recipients were Allied soldiers in the Second World War who were injured, and it had a dramatic effect, and for the first time, well, second time, sulfanilamide was quite effective, but had a more limited spectrum of activities, we would say, effectiveness, but penicillin was somewhat broader and much more potent. So now we had antibiotics therapy useful for the first time. I don't know if Thomas the Tank Engine has come to South African television. Oh, I'm so pleased, that's wonderful. Because Thomas, you remember, was a very useful engine. Well, for the first time, we could say, from 1936 to 1945, physicians now, for the first time, with the advent of antibiotics, could be very useful people. And think of what had happened in the whole history of medicine until 1945. It beggars thinking about how anybody ever survived and how we're all still here, genetically speaking. Blood transfusion, another huge advance. Now, we had known from 1901 when Landsteiner had identified specific blood groups in blood transfusion, and that in order to transfuse blood from one individual to another, the blood groups had to be compatible. Blood transfusion had been tried for hundreds of years, almost always with universally fatal results. And Landsteiner, having identified the blood groups, could then state that if you gave compatible blood, the blood could be transfused. But up until 1934, the only way of giving a blood transfusion was to lie a donor down, roll up his sleeve and use some alcohol, stick a needle in, connect the needle to a rubber tube, stick a needle in the recipient, and the blood would go from one to the other. The tourniquet on the donor to be sure it was one-way traffic. And the reason for that was, of course, there was no anticoagulant which prevented blood from clotting were you to put it in a bag and put it in a blood bank. And it was the discovery of an anticoagulant that allowed a blood bank to be formed, the first in the Mayo Clinic in Rochester in the United States in 1934. And with the advent of blood transfusion, of course, that opened up huge possibilities for surgery. So much so that the heart-lung machine was invented and open heart surgery was now possible. Now we had anesthesia, we had antibiotics, and we had blood. So now the whole field of surgery would open up with relative safety. So those are my personal views as to what the most important landmarks are, the peaks, if you will, of medicine between 1901 and 1953. And that was the watershed year, not only for the coronation of the young Queen Elizabeth II in Britain, but also also for the ascent of Mount Everest, which actually occurred 3 days before the coronation and was announced on the day of the coronation with Edmund Hillary from New Zealand and Tseng Sing Norgay from Nepal having been the first successful ascent of Mount Everest. And it was also a red letter day as well in the world of genetics. Now, genetics, of course, we knew about from Mendel's bees back in the last century, and it was well known that certain diseases or traits carried through the families, but nobody had any real idea of how that actually came about. And how it came about, of course, was through the genes, and the seminal discovery of the 1950s was, of course, that of James Watson and Francis Crick, the identification of the sequence of DNA. And this was a monumental break. This was from the University of Cambridge, and a monumental break. We had known that chromosomes, those little tiny structures within the nuclei of cells, were probably the agents whereby genetic information was transmitted from generation to generation. But up until the 1950s, it's extraordinary to relate that we never really knew exactly how many chromosomes there were in the human body in each cell, because it was very difficult to count them because they were all huddled together. And it was only the identification of a chemical which caused the chromosomes to separate that for the first time we could discover that the human body, human cells, each human cell contains 46 chromosomes, 44 of which do lots of things, and two of which are concerned with sex differentiation. And it was only in the 1950s we could say that our karyotype, which is the term for the chromosome pattern we carry, was in fact 46XX or 46XY. Isn't that extraordinary? I imagine we knew this for a century, but not so. But what did Watson and Crick actually discover was the nature of the substance of the chromosome itself, the actual DNA within the chromosome. And they discovered that it was really in the form of a stepladder. But the stepladder had undergone numerous spiral twists, and the rungs of the ladder, which is what contained the genetic information. And the rungs were very simple. They contained four very simple molecules, adenine, cytosine, thymine, and guanine. Very simple molecules, but in numerous combinations. And it's the various combinations that determined the genes. And what is a gene? A gene is a segment of the chromosome. This is a lovely diagram. I came across this only recently, which actually explained to me what a gene is. I wasn't quite sure. And if we look at the top right-hand corner, we can see this X structure with something being unraveled like a skein of wool. You have a tightly rolled skein of wool, and you start to pull out the thread. And slowly, 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 it all comes out, and miles and miles and miles of thread, having been previously tightly packed together. And if you just look at the thread, what it consists of, there is the stepladder spiraling around itself, and the rungs are the what we call the base pairs, the four structures known as A, C, E, and G, the primary letters of those four chemicals. And a segment of the chromosome would seem to have a specific function. And having identified the segment of chromosome as a specific function, we would call that segment a gene. So that's what a gene is. It's nice to see it all in one illustration. At least it satisfied me to find that illustration, which made it clear to me for the first time and then for each of you as well. The point of determining the structure of DNA allowed the whole sequence of those rungs of the ladders for the entire unraveled skein of chromosome of the DNA, pulling it out of the chromosome, it would extend miles, one would think, in terms of distance, even though it's microscopic. But the point of this was to determine what is the normal pattern within normal people of those rungs of the ladder. In other words, what is the human genome, as we call it now. And so the object was to study the genes in the chromosome so a template could be formed as normal to allow comparison to be made with somebody who was worried they may be a carrier of a genetic disease, for example, or to look at abnormalities within a patient's genome which was associated with a particular disease and thereby identify the specific cause. So the race was on to identify, establish the whole human genome, some 25,000 genes at least were recorded, billions of these molecules forming the lungs of the bladder had to be analysed. And with the aid of computers, which only came in relatively recently, it was then possible to have a paper printout of a human genome, which would be folded paper that comes out of the printer, folded upon itself many, many times, and reach a stack this high. Historically, that human genome first printout is now housed in the Wellcome Historical Museum in London and occupies 120 volumes. All packed into this little thing that you need a microscope to see. It's just absolutely extraordinary, isn't it? Well, this raised a very intriguing possibility. If you could identify a gene that was at fault causing a particular disease, could you not take a gene, which you could then, you could take a gene and manufacture it almost, if you can get that gene that's faulty put into the patient in a correct form, could you not cure that disease? It's a sort of armchair concept that you sort of discuss with your colleagues over a brandy in the evening. It's sort of a bit of science fiction. But in fact, that's exactly what has been attempted. The challenge is great. First of all, it would only be effective for dealing with diseases where only one gene is at fault, because the challenge of doing this for diseases caused by multiple gene defects simply compounds the difficulty. But there are two diseases, and very important diseases, where one gene is known to be at fault. One is haemophilia, and the other is cystic fibrosis. And if you're unfortunate enough to have a family member who's been afflicted with cystic fibrosis, you know that that can be a devastating diagnosis to make. The problem, not only therefore, was to identify conditions with a single gene that you may be able to modify by getting a correct copy, but then how do you get the gene into the patient? And the simplest way that had been tried many, many times with some success is to take advantage of what nature does. And what nature does is allows a virus to get into a cell without too much difficulty. That's where viruses do their harm, as opposed to bacteria which destroy the cells from outside by producing toxins. Viruses do their harm within the cell itself. And viruses you can play with, attenuate them, and make them less virulent and less likely to cause disease. The adenovirus was a virus that was a good candidate. And many adenoviruses were then infused with a segment of the DNA of a gene that was wanted to replace it. There's the new gene to replace the gene which is faulty in a patient. There's the virus, and the virus gets inside and multiplies itself, and copies of that gene are then made as the virus multiplies within the patient. The virus has been attenuated, so no harm comes to the patient, but hopefully the gene actually does some work. And some 2,000 patients have been treated with gene therapy. Sadly, very few of them seem to have derived any benefit, and those that have, the benefit seems to be short-lived. And there were several fatalities, unfortunately, from an allegedly a virulent virus becoming virulent and actually producing disease in the patient. And so where we are with gene therapy, this is just my personal analysis of where we are at the moment. I would stand and respectfully modify my view in the presence of a virologist or a geneticist, but my own impression is that this is still work in progress with not a lot to show for a lot of work. The story of fertility, however, is completely different. And here I think there have been amazing advances of huge benefit to the population in general. Fertility has two sides to the coin. There is preventing fertility, and here we have Mary Stopes, the botanist and feminist from University College London, working in the 1920s on contraception. And don't forget the advent of the pill, however controversial, and whatever side effects may or may not occur, has had a profound effect on women who would otherwise be childbearing drudges, having 8 or 10 or 12 children, to say nothing of the economic impact of that sort of future. So contraception has been a huge advance in terms of leaving aside the ethics and leaving aside religious discussion, and just telling from the point of view of sociology and medicine. The other side of the coin, of course, is the infertile couple. And this is a picture of Oldham, which is really a dormitory town for Manchester, in the north of England. And it is there that on the 25th of July, 1978, Louise Brown was born. And Louise Brown, of course, was the first destined baby. The problem her mother had was blocked fallopian tubes, which was a terrible infection in early adulthood. And as a result, she was ovulating normally, producing ova. Her husband was fertile, but the two couldn't meet. The ova couldn't meet the sperm because of the blocked fallopian tube. And what was done there was to harvest ova from the mother, put them in a culture medium in the laboratory, in a dish, not a test tube, but in a dish like the bacterial dish we saw Fleming had used. And then take the father's sperm and inject one into the other, so that you could then fertilize artificially. And this is the process actually in place. This dark blue structure is really just a plastic pipette held there to stop the ovum from wobbling around as you prod it with this hollow needle containing the sperm. And as you inject the sperm into the ovum, within hours, the ovum fertilized starts to multiply. You allow this process to continue to a certain point. The mother, meanwhile, has had her uterus primed with the appropriate pregnancy hormones, and then the developing embryo is transferred to her uterus, and lo and behold, 9 months later, there we are. I'm not sure what the number is now of babies who have been conceived by in vitro fertilization. It must be in the hundreds of thousands worldwide, and it has turned the definition of infertility on its head. What a monumental advance this is. A spin-off from that is an observation that was made early on in the experimental work here, and that is, if you go back to the stage where the fertilized ovum has just gone into four cells, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, before you know it, you have an embryo and a fetus. But if you go back to the four-stage cell, suck out one of the cells, surprisingly, by a mechanism I do not understand, the embryo continues to develop perfectly normally. It's as if three cells are spared, and you only need one to continue the process. That observation allows you to analyze the genetic makeup of that embryo you have just fertilized. And now it is becoming standard practice, I think, among families where there is the gene for cystic fibrosis, where the father is the carrier of the gene, the mother is the carrier of the gene, and statistically there is a 1 in 4 chance that their baby will actually have cystic fibrosis. So rather than get pregnant and hope for the best, what is now being advocated, followed by many nations, is in vitro fertilization, sampling the cells from the very early embryo, analyzing the genes, and if the baby does not have the gene for cystic fibrosis, the implantation takes place normally, just like a normal IVF baby, and if it does, then the embryo can be discarded. Now that has problems ethically, understood, but from the point of view of the family, I think this is an absolute marvelous advance. The next big advance, of course, is in body imaging. We've talked about x-rays, we haven't mentioned ultrasound, which came in the 1950s, 1960s, but it was thanks to the Japanese, who were wizards at making cameras and had really taken the monopoly away from the Leica company in Germany and were producing excellent cameras. They also developed, pioneered the development of fiber optics. And with the fiber optics, a whole new world was opening up. And here we see colonoscopy actually taking place through a Japanese-made Olympus colonoscope, passing a light through a channel and a telescope so you can see what's going on. And here you actually have a view into the colon of a patient, and this orange lump is, of course, a tumor which needs to be removed. And as a consequence of the good visualization you see on colonoscopy, by extension, instead of going through orifices like the stomach or from the rear, why not look into the abdominal cavity? And so you can make a little incision in the abdominal wall, pass in what is essentially a colonoscope and look. And then the instruments became progressively refined, and now we have keyhole laparoscopic surgery as a spin-off from the camera industry in Japan, if you like. That's the one few things to remember. The problem with laparoscopic surgery is it's quite tiring. You have to make 3 little incisions, nothing really wrong with that. You put in 3 instruments, the camera, the instrument with which you're going to do things, like a little scalpel or a needle to sew, and something else to hold and grasp. And it's quite tiring. You have your arms in this position for 2 or 3 hours at a time. Any little tremor that you may have gets magnified. And this was really the stimulus for the developing of the surgical robot, of which you've probably read, if not actually seen. And this actually smooths out, by computer technology, those movements, and the surgeon can now sit, doesn't even have to be scrubbed, doesn't even have to be in the same room, and doesn't even have to be in the same town or country to do this operation. The idea that came for this came from the US military, heavily involved in Vietnam and consequently other exploitations. And as a consequence of that, the thought rose that in order to achieve better casualty recovery rates on the battlefield, if you had your expert vascular surgeon sitting in Cincinnati, he could actually help you in Kandahar. And the technology is there. You just send the electronic message up to the satellite and it all gets done. And I joke not, this can be done. But in reality, because for medical legal reasons, if nothing else, the surgeon sitting at his console is 2 minutes away from being scrubbed, lest anything untoward happened, and he could revert to a more conventional procedure. X-rays improved enormously. It occurred to Geoffrey Hansfield, who was a physicist working for the EMI Corporation in Britain, that instead of having just one source of X-ray that Bronsham had really described 100 years before, almost, why not have 8 sources of X-rays and 8 little screens? And with computer technology, you can build almost a 3-dimensional image of the patient. And this is a CT scan, which has done exactly that. And what it does through computer technology is marries together 8 images that are done. And in fact, you iron out the difference between the location of each X-ray source and screen simply by rotating the whole boom around. And you end up with what in fact amount to slices, as if you were lying on a table, a moving table, and a bandsaw is going through you. And you can see very beautifully the internal anatomy, the vertebral column at the back, the white of the segments of the ribs. They look like lots of ribs because they're angulated and the cut is in a horizontal axis. And here you can see the great vessels just above the heart, and the black are the lungs, and the little white areas are cartilage within the bronchii and bronchioles. So absolutely wonderful advance. And now for the first time, you could see solid organs. The Achilles heel of conventional X-rays was that it was wonderful for the lungs where you had air, it was wonderful for bones, but it was pretty poor for solid organs. Nuclear medicine advanced also in a way that we would scarcely have believed 10 years ago. You can now inject a radioisotope, ask a patient to waggle his middle finger, and part of the brain which is activated actually lights up. Replacement surgery. The first really in the 1950s, cardiac pacemakers, followed by artificial hips, and replacement surgery then went on to transplantation. And transplantation really started in the 1950s with kidney transplantation, and here are the Werich brothers, the first recipient of a successful kidney transplant in the United States, successful because they were identical twins. And this averted the problem that was for the devil and still the devil's transplant surgery, that of rejection. And it's thanks to this man, Peter Medawar, who was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1960 for analyzing the mechanism of tissue rejection, organ rejection, and developing medications, azathioprine and cortisol, which are actually effective at suppressing the immune response that causes rejection. And this opened up transplantation to others than identical twins. And of course, everybody knows Chris Barnard. I arrived at Great Cross Children's Hospital in 1977, several months after he had carried out the first cardiac transplant at Goethe School. And I had the honor of knowing every variety of Chris Barnard's underwear. Why? because he and I shared the same locker room. His locker was next to mine. And at 20 every Tuesday morning, I could see what he was wearing. And there is a heart transplant. Technically, not all that demanding. We've got big tubes to join together. The difficult part of vascular surgery is when you're trying to join small tubes together. Big tubes, pretty easy. You stop the heart, you have blood available, not a problem. And the wires allow you to connect it up to give it a shock, to get it there again and restore the patient's circulation. And within immunosuppression, the results of cardiac transplantation are now very different. You remember Mr. Wyszynski, who survived 18 days, followed by Dr. Blyberg, who survived opposite 569 days, the second recipient of a transplanted heart. Today, in the United States, there are 2,000 heart transplants are done every year, with an average survival, 5-year survival of over 70%. So what a remarkable advance that has been, so transplantation. In order to overcome the problem of rejection, because it's still a problem, a new approach has been tissue engineering. You've read about tissue engineering. I'm not sure that it has a future. But in principle, it's really very straightforward. You take some cells from the patient himself, grow them in the laboratory so they're amplified, and you end up with a whole sheet of cells, and you can see that process taking place on the screen there. And you create, you cultivate the cells, then you allow them to proliferate, and then you have a matrix in any shape you want, the matrix of some absorbable, biologically compatible material, which you then lay your cells on, and it acts as a template. And having done that, you can then make your matrix in the template in the form of a tube, sew it with endothelial cells, which are the cells that line blood vessels, and create a new vein, or even a new aorta. And that's wonderful for a single tissue organ. But the problem is that most organs are multi-tissue organs, and it's very difficult to get cells of different origins to mesh together, let alone function. So tissue engineering has been going really for 15 years, and in truth, it is yet to translate to anything therapeutically very valuable. However sophisticated you may be in the design of your template, here is a cardiac valve that has been engineered, for example, by the template being in the shape of the valve, but not really therapeutically used. An alternative approach is to use stem cells. Now stem cells are, we're all embryos, we all started as a stem cell because we started as two cells, the result of fusion of a sperm and an ovum. And from that fusion, over 200 cell types eventually evolve as the embryo develops into a fetus. So clearly, the genetic potential is there for a very early developing cell to go any which way. And the art of stem cell therapy is to coax the cell to go in the direction in which you want it to go. And this has proved very difficult. There have been successes in the laboratory. For example, we see stem cells in blue at the top of the screen there, which have been induced to turn into neurons, nerve cells. And then you can see with a different stain in orange below how those stem cells look like the fibers of nerve cells. But in fact, try as people have made to make stem cells do anything therapeutically beneficial, it has been only beneficial in one situation clinically, and that is in the treatment of resistant leukemias. And there are many patients who are enjoying perfect health as a result of stem cell therapy by wiping out their malignant bone marrow cells. The message has gone wrong in their bone marrow, and they're producing cells which are harmful instead of beneficial to the body. Wipe those out, protect the patient from infection while they're not having any white cells, and then sew their marrow with stem cells, and lo and behold, those stem cells can multiply and produce normal marrow. And there are many patients who owe their life to this technology. But that is the only case I'm aware of where stem cells have proved to be beneficial. But if you're that recipient, my gosh, what an advance. And then the final area I wanted to address with you was that of medical ethics. Now, we've talked a lot about medical ethics. We talked about the Hippocrates, we talked about Galen, we talked about Rhazes, Avicenna, we talked about Maimonides. But then medical ethics seemed to disappear from the window. from our consciousness until the horrors of the Nazi regime came to light. And it was only in 1945 that we realized that as physicians we had really ignored this vital aspect of our oath to our patients. And this is I hesitate to show you this picture from a German Nazi archive of a prisoner being subjected to pressure decompression experiments in order to simulate some concept as to what might happen to an airline pilot who goes back to a fighter pilot who may go very high without his oxygen. Unspeakable. Even more unspeakable was Mengele's experiments with twin children, to the point that he even injected dye into the eyes of children to try to change. I can't even finish the sentence. Not surprisingly, 27 doctors were tried on the Nuremberg trial, including Karl Brandt, who was Hitler's personal physician, and also Reichskommissar for Health and Sanitation. And he was executed on the grounds that he had been overseeing all of these things. The Israeli Mossad was interested in finding, found Eichmann, of course, was interested in finding Mengele. He disappeared to Argentina after the war, and this is a house photographed by the Mossad in Paraguay, where he was known to be holed up. But before anything could be done to bring him to justice, he disappeared to Brazil, where some years later he died in Africa. But it's easy to throw stones. I mean, nobody disputes throwing stones at the Nazi doctors. But the Americans are not entirely blameless. And this is a photograph taken during a notorious study that was carried out in the United States, the so-called Tuskegee study, which was to look at the natural history of syphilis. The study started, if I just correct myself here, in 1932, when there was no treatment for syphilis. So one might argue that there was no ethical dilemma here. But with the advent of silversan and the advent of sulfanilamide, and certainly the advent of penicillin, there was indeed grounds for stopping the study because this condition could now be treated. But the study continued into 1972. And what was done was 600 black American sharecroppers were recruited, 400 had syphilis, 200 were controls, and they were all simply observed over this period, unconscionable now. And that was a sobering observation. And it was because we had neglected the ethical aspect of medicine. Ethical dilemmas still remain, of course. What do you do with a discarded embryo when you look to see whether the embryo has cystic fibrosis or not? Or when you're doing in vitro fertilization, you can't just rely on one single embryo. You would take many embryos to try to get, first of all, the embryo to take, and then you would know which one was successfully implanted to the mother. So you would have half a dozen or a dozen embryos. The ethical dilemma, what you do, when does life begin? These my residents and medical students, when I say, tell me about this baby you've just seen, and the baby said, the medical student would say, this baby is 3 days of life. And then I turn around and I say, when did life begin? And the silence, and that's a big dilemma. There are problems at the end of life. Jack Kevorkian. Is it right to leave somebody in a vegetative state alive, somebody with atrial myelitis, with Lou Gehrig's disease, paralysis, with the mind still active, who wants to die? So we've come a long way. Technically, we know no bounds. But the problem that arises is that back on Earth, there are many problems still to be solved. We know very little about the care of the elderly. We know very little about Alzheimer's disease and its treatment, arthritis, the huge social orders, social problems that arise, the inequities between rich countries and poor countries. And I think we've also lost the art of being the family friend and the doctor. I thank you so much for your attention.